Here. Hey everybody, thank you for joining us today. Today we're on Skype a Scientist Live talking all about plants and how they move, which is so weird and cool, and I'm really excited to hear about it. So generally speaking, here's some housekeeping stuff we have going on Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be talking about bugs with Gwen Pearson. Next week, we've got a full schedule. Check out the website, skypeascientist.com. Click the live stream link, and you'll see all the things we have going on. For the first 3 weeks of June, we are jam-packed. We're partnering with a queer professional society called Noble Step. They're doing really awesome work, and we're partnering with a bunch of queer scientists to show that they're doing a lot of really cool work. We've got people talking about triceratops, hagfish slime, explosions in space that look like fireworks, disaster drones, like all sorts of just super cool stuff. So get excited about that. This week on Thursday, that's tomorrow night, I'm going to be doing trivia for adults with Jason Ward, the bird biologist. So that's going to be super exciting. That's happening at 8 p.m. Eastern time. And that's the only thing in Skype a Scientist that we charge for at all. It's kind of how we raise a little bit of money for keeping our program afloat. So if you're an adult and want to come, you should totally do that. These nights are super fun. You can either bring some folks with you and join a team or make new friends there. We have lots of people who show up by themselves and then get join up with new folks to geek out about science with and just hang out on a Thursday night online during bummer pandemic times. Otherwise, you can support our program. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, so you can support us at patreon.com/skypeascientist or paypal.me/skypeascientist. And that's really all the housekeeping we've got today. So I'm going to be not visible today because my internet's being a little freaky, but you'll hear me and I'll ask questions out loud and then Joyce will answer them all for us. So at this point, Joyce, would you like to introduce yourself, say who you are, what you do, why you like it, and then we'll launch into some questions?
Hi, can you hear me?
You sound great.
Okay. So I'm calling in from the Zoom on my phone. So if you need to pick up my phone, that's because I have to do that also for internet problems.
Yeah.
But I'm here. So my name is Joyce Cherry. I am a plant biologist, which means that I study the evolution, development, and just natural history of plants around the world. And I've been studying plants for about 8 years now. I started as an undergrad in Cornell University, where I studied plant sciences, and then I had some time where I worked at a museum at Harvard in Boston, and then I did my PhD in plant evolutionary biology at University of California, Berkeley. So I've been doing this plant thing for a while. It's really fun. I specifically like to study how plants move, which is a unique phenomenon, because as you can see when you look around the forest or you see in the street trees, you see most plants are straight up and erect and they don't move, but some plants do actually move. So I study those guys. Those are called vines. And I work right now at Penn State, where I'm studying the cell wall of plants. So one thing that makes plants different than animals is that they have something called the cell wall, as you'll know from all your courses. And so we're studying how that part of the plant develops and the sugars that make up that part of the plant that makes it specifically different than animals. I'm originally from New York. I'm from Long Island. I grew up in Long Island. And so I spent a little bit of time in the West Coast for grad school. I've been in Central and South America for studies. And now I'm back in the East Coast at Penn State. And I'll soon be moving to Cornell to become a professor.
Awesome. Great. Thanks for the introduction. So our first question is from Ruth. And that is, why do plants move?
Yeah, that's a great question. So most plants actually move just a little bit. So what you'll see when you're observing a plant, for the most part, a tree, is that they seem to be stagnant in place. They don't move at all. But some parts do have to move a little bit in order to act as light. So for example, the plants that I study are vines. And what makes these plants different than trees is that they do not create these big trunks and these big branches. Instead, what they do is create these smaller trunks, and they have to sort of swivel through the forest canopy in between the tree trunks to try to act as light. So why are they moving? They're trying to get closer to the top of the forest canopy so they can get some light. So it's a way to cheat, basically. And so some plants move faster than others in order so they can cheat.
Sounds good. The next question from J-Rob is, why do you like plants so much? What is it about plants that just like captures you?
Oh my God, that's such a funny question. So I didn't grow up interested in plants or animals. So it's not like I made some type of distinction in my life where I was like, no, it won't be animals, it will be plants. It was more like why do I like plants? It's just kind of, I went to Haiti where my parents are from, and for whatever reason, we were out taking a hike and I became really excited about all the different flowers I saw in the tropics and all of the different colors. And there's such different plants that go on in the tropical forest. If you've ever been to the Caribbean, for example, that are different than those trees that I grew up in New York seeing. And for whatever reason, this observation became interesting to me. And so I started to think more about what makes plants different than one another. And it wasn't a comparison to animals per se, it was just specifically, I just became intrigued by plants. I don't really know why. And then I started to go to the Botanical Garden in New York, the New York Botanical Garden, which is in the Bronx, where I was able to see more variety of trees. And shrubs and vines and all sorts of different flowers. And the question just became larger, which is, why are there so many different species of plants? Why do they look so different than each other? Why are they around the world in different positions and in the elevation and different latitudes? So it came, why plants? I'm really not sure. It's just something that naturally sparked within me. I was about 20 years old and I just went with it.
Sounds good. The next question is from Gavin. Why are chloroplasts green, and was it always green? And are there proteins to make the traits of plants the same or different from humans?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Why are chloroplasts green? Chloroplasts are green because they are filled with something called chlorophyll. And so chlorophyll is a pigment inside of chloroplasts that are absorbing the light from the environment and then emitting green back. So plants are green because they absorb the different wavelengths of color and then they emit back the green wavelength. And that's because of the absorption of chlorophyll that's in the chloroplast. So that's what makes plants green, is that they have something called chlorophyll, and we don't have this. So we can't photosynthesize.
Cool. Are there any animals that use chloroplasts?
I don't think so. I do think that there are some algae that have chloroplasts, but I'm not really sure. I think there are some algae that can photosynthesize, meaning that they do have some capacity to have chlorophyll.
Yeah. I think there are these sea slugs that live on Martha's Vineyard and other places as well that basically steal the chloroplasts from plants and then put them in skin and then like get energy from that. And that's like so weird. It's so cool. So I mean, it's they don't make them themselves. They just take them from the plants. But it's like, it's wild looking. So look up like photosynthesizing sea slugs. They're bright green. They're so cool. When I was in grad school, another lab was studying those, which are awesome.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're weird and silly. And they like so you have them in this like little circular tank that has a flow going in a circle called a Kreisel tank. And they like to like let go of the side of the tank and ride the wave in little circles, and it's very funny. But anyway, let's get back to plants away from slugs. I can talk about invertebrates all day. The next question is, how have plants evolved over time?
Wow, that's a really amazing question. So plants, the first kind of plants that we understand to be like plants in the strict sense were similar to mosses. So if you know what a moss looks like, they're kind of like a little, they almost look like grass. So it's really quote unquote simple in their makeup. And through time, through different evolutionary events that caused some lineages to split off from other lineages, then there was the evolution of ferns. Ferns being, let's see if we know any common ferns. I don't know. I think most folks know ferns. They are usually not too large. They're pretty small. They have that little swirly thing at the tip, and then they grow out and they expand their leaves. So the ferns, they evolve. And then there was this really impressive evolutionary event at 125 million years ago called the evolution of seed plants. So prior to 125 million years ago, plants did not produce seeds. They only were able to produce spores. So as you're familiar with mosses, they don't produce seeds, and ferns also do not produce seeds. So at 125 million years ago, there was this crazy evolutionary event that no one really knows how this came to be. This is like a great mystery in the evolution of plants, and people like Darwin have been curious about this forever, which is why the seed evolved. But as soon as the seed evolved in the plant lineage, then there were the gymnosperms, which are like the conifers, the pine trees, and things like that, and ginkgo biloba. And there was the emergence of the flowers. That was the next evolutionary step, if you will, which is that once we got seeds, then we could get flowers. And so flowers was like kind of like the last most important thing that happened in the evolutionary biology of plants. Not necessarily the most important, but in terms of major events. And so once the flower evolved, then now if you look around, you know, anywhere you are, you see all the diversity of different flowers. So then that became like the catapulting point of, okay, now we have all these different diversity of flowers that have formed around the whole world. And they do, they have different relationships with different pollinators. So some are with bees, some are with bats, some are with birds. So that became kind of like a niche that opened up and allowed plants to differentiate from each other. So it kind of was like small little mossy things, fern things, and then boom, seeds. And then you had like big trees, and then you had flowers.
Awesome. All right, the next question is about carnivorous plants. So how does a Venus flytrap get nutrients from eating bugs, and why don't other plants eat food?
So why do some plants eat bugs and while most plants don't? So one of the most basic fundamental things to learn about plants and why they're different than animals is that they are autotrophs. That means that they make their own food. So that's the idea of photosynthesis, which is that I take light from the sun, and then I can convert that into sugars and I can feed myself. That's why plants are so distinct from animals, because they can feed themselves. But some plants cannot feed themselves because, for example, they don't have enough nutrients in the soils nearby to supplement their diet, if you will. So some of the food comes from photosynthesis, and then the rest of the nutrients that are necessary for plants to live and be happy are coming from the soil. So the soil, we need three very important nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. That's what K is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, K is potassium. So I haven't thought about this in a while. So those are the three main nutrients that are necessary in the soil for a plant to be happy. So some plants, they live in soils that don't have nitrogen, phosphorus, or potassium, enough of it for them to be happy. So what they do instead is they eat bugs, because bugs have some of the nutrients that they need to live. So how does a Venus flytrap do it? So if you ever saw a Venus flytrap, you have to look pretty closely. Don't touch it yet, because then it'll close. But if you look pretty closely, what you'll see is there's three hairs inside of the trap. And then if you press on two hairs, it will really rapidly close the trap, and it'll engulf whatever is inside. And so what's inside of the trap are these digestive enzymes that can break down the bug that gets trapped inside. And then by breaking down the bug, it's extracting the nutrients from the bug. So it's similar, I guess, similar to what you mentioned about the slug and how it uses the chloroplast from other plants. Not exactly the same idea, but sometimes there's this plants and animals can communicate like this. They can take from each other. And so in the case of plants that eat animals, they basically take the nutrients from them. So why doesn't everyone do this? Because everyone else is living in good soil.
Fair enough. So on that note, kind of, do you think that humans will ever be able to do what plants do when they photosynthesize?
Well, no, unfortunately, because we don't have the packaging to take light and make food. At least I don't think so. What is the packaging? The packaging is the chloroplast, the pigments inside of the chloroplast that actually absorb light and then can convert it through a series of chemical reactions into sugar. We don't have that, I don't think. So I don't think we're on our way. Sometimes when you go to the grocery store, they have things that have chlorophyll in them, and I don't really know how this fad came about, but it's not going to make you make your own food. It's just
no, I don't think so. I don't know really what it's doing for you, but people are definitely drinking it.
Question
from Emma is, what's your favorite flower?
What's my favorite flower? So there's a really cool flower called Amorphophallus titum. So I would type it in, but I don't actually know where to type it in. So there's a really cool flower called Amorphophallus titum. It's huge. It's like 6 feet tall, and it flowers every like 10 or 12 years. And only a few botanical gardens around the world have it. So you can go to, Cornell University has one, and I don't really know who else has one, but some of these botanical gardens, you can see them, and it becomes a big event when they flower because it's such a rare event. So when they flower, they create this giant flower, like I said, it's like taller than a human being, and it's pollinated by mosquitoes. And so anything that's pollinated by mosquitoes is going to produce a really funky, rotting smell, because mosquitoes really love the smell of rotten meat. And so this flower has evolved to create the smell of rotten meat so that it can attract a bunch of mosquitoes to pollinate it, and then it can produce its fruit after that. So that's a pretty funky flower. It's giant, like I said. So if you can look it up, it's called, so the scientific name is Amorphophallus kind of, but the common name is, the skunk plant? No. I don't know.
This, I only know the scientific name. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can sometimes type in corpse flower, and I think that'll
pop up. Perfect.
Yeah, there's
that's the right name.
Types of flower, I think, called the corpse flower. But that's actually on one of the Skype a Scientist t-shirts, that flower, because we thought it was.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. All right. So the next question is, what are some of the most interesting plants you've seen?
Most interesting plants I see, you know, every plant is basically interesting in its own right. I think that's a pretty like basic answer, but it's true, which is why they evolved to be distinct from each other, because they all have something distinct about them. But what would I say would be the craziest plant? So I did some field work in graduate school in Panama, in the forest of Panama, and there were some vines called fire vines that when you touched it, when you rubbed it up against it in the forest, it would burn your skin. So people were really like nervous about coming in contact with this fire vine. I never actually came in contact with it for some reason. Maybe they knew I was friendly to vines and they just didn't come to get me. But so that's a thing where you can touch up against some plants and they'll burn you. I think some of these poisonous plants are pretty interesting, such as poison ivy. Like if you just touch the roots of poison ivy, you touch the leaves of poison ivy, you just get in contact with it like at all, it can be pretty bad for you. So I think, why do I think that's interesting? Because plants are still in their position for the most part and can't move too much, or at least they certainly can't move from the soil and walk away. They can only move their sort of leaves. They have to come up with all sorts of ways to protect themselves just in case. So just in case a predator comes and wants to eat and chew all of its leaves down, some species have evolved all these toxins. So I think some plants like poison ivy are pretty cool. That fire vine I just mentioned is pretty cool. But what's important is that you know what they look like so that you don't get hurt by them. So those are pretty cool ones. Let me see if I can mention one more. So I think that's all I'll mention for now, poisonous plants.
That sounds good. The next question is, do any other plants move other than vines?
Yeah, so a lot of plants move. If you ever were to take, if you have any plants in your house and you were to set up a time-lapse video of it, like if you were to set up your phone camera and just take a picture once an hour, for example, for just a day, you'll actually notice that all your plants move. They all move a little bit. They all sway a little bit in the night. Often plants will close their leaves up in the middle of the night. They have no reason to put them out. The reason you have your leaves out in the first place is to act as light, but at night you could just kind of close it up. Some plants even close their flowers at night because there's no pollinators around anyway, so I might as well just take a nap. So a lot of plants, if you were to take a video of the plants that you have in your house, you'll notice that they move. It's just that vines are the most dramatic in that they will like swing and wrap and like basically they can suffocate other plants. Most plants are not going to be a parasite, if you will, to another plant. They'll just move within their own little confines, and they're not looking for another plant to hurt.
Cool. Gavin would like to know, how are plants used to make medicine? And how and why do plants have the stuff we need to use for medicine?
So plants around the whole world are used for medicine. There's a lot of species of plants. So there's at least of the flowering plants, there's about 250,000 species. So not all plants can be used for medicine, but many of them can be and have been used for thousands of years by people. Why do plants have some of the things we need? This is a question I don't know why. I don't think that science can tell us why we have this relationship with plants. I guess that'll be my answer, is that I don't know why we have this relationship with plants. I think that's a big philosophical question.
Yeah, totally. Sometimes we just don't know the answer. Sometimes things are still mysterious, and that's what makes science fun. The next question is, you're a plant scientist, but what does a day in a plant scientist look like? Like, what does it look like to study plants? Like, what are you doing day to day?
Yeah, so it changes. Being a scientist in general every day is different. But let's see, so the last couple of times I was in the lab, what does the day look like? The day looks like, right now I'm studying the bean vine. So the beans that you eat and put in your rice and everything come from a vining plant. And I'm growing those plants because I'm studying how their cell walls are allowing them to move. And the last time I was in lab, I was planting new bean seeds. So I had to sterilize them with bleach, and then I put them in this growth chamber, these sterilized seeds, so that they can sprout. And then the same day, I was doing some experiments called immunolabeling, in which you basically can attach a tag to a protein in the plant and then image a fluorescent dye that's attached to the protein. So this is a little bit complicated, but to summarize what that means, I'm just taking pictures of certain proteins in the plant or certain sugars in the plant. I was doing that on a microscope and simultaneously planting these new bean plants. So some days look like you are holding the plants in your hand and you're planting them in pots and you are taking measurements of the height of the plant, taking measurements of the size of the leaves. Some days you have to kill the plant so you can do certain analyses, like you need to image their cells or you need to break them down into their DNA or their RNA so you can understand what's going on in the molecular basis. So depending on the aim of the day, the work will change, but it'll fluctuate anywhere between planting plants to looking at the DNA of plants on the computer.
Cool. Do you have any inspirations in science, people, or maybe discoveries that inspired you when you were younger?
You know, not in science. So I was inspired by art as a child. My whole family are artists. My brother's an artist, my mother's an artist, musical and visual artist. And I became interested early in my life about the process of making something and testing something out and creating things from scratch that were beautiful and original. So I became familiar with that process. And I think when I transitioned into science, it was that process that I was so familiar with creating something new, having the patience to redo it over and over again until it's kind of perfected to the way that I want it to. And then that translated really easily into setting a hypothesis, testing it out, having the perseverance to do the experiments over and over again, coming up with an answer. Writing a paper is like writing, I mean, it's a piece of art also to write a scientific paper. So I didn't have scientific inspiration as a child. I just had the inspiration of the mechanics of what of art, which is the same as the mechanics of doing science.
I think that's a really common theme that we've seen with a lot of scientists that we've been talking to over the last months. Like, art and science are so much more similar than I think society gives them credit for. Like, both are super, you know, you have to be super observative. And you're just kind of like, you know, exploring what's true. Sometimes emotionally, sometimes with data. And yeah, that's like totally something I think it's a really good lesson for people, especially when they're young, how similar science and art are. The next question is, do you have any hobbies or interests outside of being a scientist?
Of course. I've been playing guitar since I was in sixth grade, so I still very much enjoy playing music. I write little science raps sometimes, which is still kind of related to science, but it's okay. It's another venue for it. So I write a little bit of science raps. I enjoy sketching and painting. I enjoy writing for leisure. Like, I wrote a poem last week about the forest. I really gotta stay away from these plants, huh? And let's see. So I really enjoy taking really long walks. I've recently been doing some African dancing, which I hope to keep as a hobby.
Amazing.
So a couple of things.
Cool. Sounds good. The next question is, do you think that plants would be flourishing or less flourishing without humans?
I think they would be more flourishing because we as people have occupied so much of the natural forested areas of the world, cutting them down for building apartment buildings, of course, and just building cities. So we've deforested a lot of the world in favor of our human needs. And so what would be in place of that would have been just massive amounts of forest. So would plants flourish more? Yes. But why do I have a but? I have a but because what does flourish really mean? Like, we would have to define what we mean by flourish. Do we mean that they would have evolved differently? I don't know. Does it mean that there would be more successful plants? I also don't know either. I guess the only flourish I think would benefit if we didn't deforest most of the world is that there would be more plants. But I don't know what that means in terms of the evolution of plants, competition between plants.
Yeah.
But for the most part, yeah, I would say that they flourish, but we'd have more plants. But what does more plants really mean?
Yeah, totally. The next question is interesting. It's from Arabella. Is there any truth to the claim that plants react to music?
Yes, there is some science to that. It's not that it's the music per se. It's the sound waves that the plant is responding to. So it's not, I don't think it's like, you know, I like Beyonce. I think it's like, I just like the beat. And I actually came across a plant like this in the greenhouse at Penn State that apparently responds to music, and we played a couple of songs. So we played a Kesha song because it was really upbeat and it did not take. And then we played like a rock and roll song and it started to sway a little bit. So maybe it is a little bit more specific than that than I thought it was. But yeah, there is some plants. It's not all plants, but there are some plants that do respond to sound waves.
That's super cool. Kristen would like to know, do you think plants can remember things and then act accordingly?
So it's not really a memory they have. They have it's almost like they're genetically programmed to respond to certain stimuli. So for example, it's not that the plants, when they're growing up, remember, oh, it's spring, oh, it's summer, I gotta get ready. It's more like their bodies are genetically predisposed to respond to the changing environment, and so then they respond with the program that they're already prescribed with. So what I mean by that is, like, when it starts to get cold, for example, in the fall in the East Coast. It's not that the plants remember, oh, I remember last fall, I better like close up my leaves and close up shop. It's more like their genes tell them it's time to close up shop. And they got those genes that they inherited through evolutionary biology. So they just inherited that through time. So it's not necessarily a memory per se.
Okay, cool. The next question is, how exactly do plants move? Do they just grow in the direction that they're moving, or is there something else going on there?
Yeah, that's great. So they move in a couple of ways. Woody plants move through a cell wall layer that is basically gelatinous. So instead of, so most cell walls are really tough. They're really rigid, tough layers. But in plants that need to sway and bend, if they're woody, they actually produce cell wall layers that are sort of squishy. And the squishiness of the cell wall allows that part of the plant to be more flexible so it can bend and twist and bend and twist. So there's something going on with the cell wall is being modified so it's a little bit more flexible. So that's one way. Another way is that in a ring, if you cut open a plant and you look at it in cross section, so that's like bird's eye view, there's going to be a ring of cells in the outside, on the outermost layer of cells. And those outermost layer of cells are actually the signaling cells in terms of the gravity position. So that when, if the plant is, so it's sensing gravity. And while it's sensing gravity, it's telling the plant to reposition itself because I'm falling, for example. So if a plant is falling, these gravity cells will tell the plant, I'm falling, so it's time to stand back up. So there are actual cells that have the job of telling the plant where you are in 3D space, and it's time to move.
Cool. The next question is, can certain plant stems change color?
I mean, the answer is basically yes, in terms of bark. So some plants have really, I don't know if you know the specifics of the question, but do you mean over the course of the life of a plant, or do you mean in response to something?
Let's say both. Certainly it can over the course of its life. But yeah, however you feel like answering.
Yeah, so the can the stem of a plant change color? I mean, yes, I guess so. So it's not going to be a big difference between brown and green. It's mostly going to be between this brown and this other brown. So shades of the same brown, maybe a little bit more red sometimes. The bark of the plant is one of the last layers of cells that are laid down, and sometimes those cells can be different across the tree. So maybe the older branches have a darker brown and the newer branches have a lighter brown. That's not very interesting. There are some barks of trees that are green, which is really interesting. And why are they green? Because actually the bark cells can photosynthesize, so they have chlorophyll in the bark. So that's kind of cool. But for the most part, it's just shades of brown, and then you have the occasional bark that can photosynthesize.
Cool. The next question is, what are some ways that plant diversity is being affected by climate change and pollution?
So in terms of climate change and pollution. Okay, so one of the, I think the response of plants is similar to animals in that we see a displacement of plants. So what does that mean? That means that plants that used to be in this zone of the world, for example, are no longer here. Now they've moved to a different zone of the world where it's a little bit cooler. I don't really follow the climate change plant so well, but I do know that plants are not exactly in the same position that they naturally would be in some parts of the world where it's been too hot.
Sounds good. Let's see. Does humidity affect the growth rate of plants?
Oh, yes, yeah, certainly. So the growth rate of plants is determined by all sorts of factors in terms of the soil. Like I mentioned, the nutrients in the soil. It's affected by the sunlight, and of course it's affected by the rainfall, and it's affected by the humidity and the atmosphere and the duration of all of those things. So yeah, humidity is a big thing. So for example, some plants need a lot of humidity, and then some plants cannot handle the humidity. So depending on the species, some plants love it, some plants hate it, but that just tells us that humidity is very important for plant development.
Cool. So what do you think is like your favorite part of your job?
Ooh. My favorite part of my job is coming up with new ideas, coming up with reading and coming up with new ideas and then letting my mind run free without judgment of like, is this exactly correct? Am I scientifically perfect right now? No, just like the moments when I'm able to just be as creative as possible, write out my ideas, talk to other people about them, and just see what contribution I can make to science. I think that can be really fun to realize like, oh, this question has never been answered before. Like, you know, a lot of the questions that were asked today are scientific questions that need further development. And I think having the chance to sit back and think about what next question do I want to answer and how do I want to do it? Where do I need to go in the world to answer that question? What collaborators do I need to reach out to? What language do I need to speak to get the question answered? They're a really exciting moment. So the best part is just brainstorming.
Awesome. I completely agree. That's one of the best parts. It's awesome. And here's a question. Okay. What's your favorite house plant? And how do I not kill house plants that I have in my house?
Oh no, this is like the common problem with people who are plant scientists is that we actually can be often really bad at taking care of our own plants. So I'm in transition now because I'm moving from Pennsylvania to New York and I don't have any plants in my house. So I can't even, I won't pretend to be an expert on taking care of plants. I think that most people would say that the easiest plants to take care of in your house are all the succulents, because you don't even really have to remember that they're there. Just every 2 weeks, you got to remember them. Once a week, you got to remember them. So no, I'm horrible at keeping plants alive.
I have the opposite problem because I'm used to taking care of squid that need like constant attention and care. So I end up overwatering plants and then just killing them that way. So I need to find a way to chill and just let my plants exist without over-mothering them. Okay, great. So we try to have these last about 45 minutes. And so we want to ask you the same two questions that we ask everybody at the end of these sessions. And the first is, what do you wish everyone in the world knew about your area of expertise? And then the second question is, what is something that you wish everybody in the world knew about literally anything?
Whoa. Huh. Wow, that's a great question. What do I want people to know about my expertise? I want people to know that vines are increasing in abundance in the tropical forests around the world, which has been not hyped up too much. And it's actually one of the things that's happening in response to climate change is that there are a lot of vines growing in the tropical forest. And the problem with that is that they are killing the trees, which are potentially the most important part of the tropical forest in terms of timber, but in terms of carbon biomass for carbon sequestration, so it can chew up all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, is usually the trees. But the vines are growing so rapidly right now, and we don't really know why they're growing so rapidly in response to increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and increasing temperatures, but they're killing all these trees. So I think that's an important thing for people to know is that, yeah, vines are cool because they are able to move and cheat, but right now they're cheating pretty badly and they're killing all the trees in the process. The other thing I want everyone to know about everything, is that the question? Just something I want everyone to know?
Yeah, just it could be like as silly and insignificant or significant as you'd like.
I think I want people to know that you can set your destiny and you can set your destiny, you can write it yourself, and you can enjoy the journey even when it's hard, And that can be more fulfilling than getting to the destination, which has been what I'm learning about my own career in plant biology as someone who didn't think I would study plants ever and randomly fumbled upon it and sort of had to fight my way through my family who was like, what is this plant thing? And writing my own story and enjoying my journey has been the most fulfilling thing possible. And I'm really excited to continue to do it. I'm only 27. I can't wait to keep doing it for the rest of my life. But yeah, it was tough to set the journey, but I did, and it was the best thing I could do. And I would recommend everyone to sort of reflect on how they can do that too.
That's really beautiful. Thank you. That's perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. And Erin, thank you for signing for us as always. Is there anything that you would like to share with everybody, like any places we can follow you on social media, anything you'd like to plug, anything like that?
Oh, I'm not that interesting, so I have no plug.
Thank you for offering. Okay, great. So everybody else, if you can support our program, please do at patreon.com/skypeascientist or one-time donations at paypal.me/skypeascientist. We are almost completely donor supported and we rely on small donations to keep this ship afloat. On Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern, we're going to be talking about bugs. On Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern, I think we're going to be talking about space with a woman named Erin. And then I don't remember what we're doing Tuesday, but every day next week we've got something going on. And if you're interested in being part of our newsletter, check out skypeascientist.com and there's a way to sign up for our newsletter there. And that way you'll get notifications once a week on Sundays. I'll send out everything that's going on that week so you don't miss anything. You can always find out what's happening on skypeascientist.com. On the live streams tab, we've got calendars, links, everything you could possibly need. And I hope, adults, that we see some of you on Thursday night, tomorrow night, at Science After Hours Trivia. Thank you again, Joyce, for taking the time to be with us. This was super fun. I've learned a lot. And Erin, thanks for signing. And we will see you all on Friday.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.